Mark chapter 9, verses 2 to 13. And you'll find it on page 1012 in the Pew Bibles and on the screen. And he said to them, I tell you the truth. Some who are standing here will not taste death before they see that the kingdom of God come with power. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up to a high mountain where they were alone. There he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. And there appeared before them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up 3 shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. He did not know what to say, they were so frightened. Then a cloud appeared and enveloped them, and a voice came from the cloud, This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him. Suddenly, when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. And as they were coming down the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. They kept the matter to themselves, discussing what rising from the dead meant. And they asked him, Why do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first? Jesus replied, To be sure, Elijah does come first and restores all things. Why then is it written that the Son of Man must suffer much and be rejected? But I tell you, Elijah has come, and they have done to him everything they wished, just as it is written about him. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
So I spend part of my ministry in working in a city of Durban, which some of you might not know, but it's in South Africa. It's on the east coast. The county is called, we call it a province, KwaZulu-Natal. And the word Zulu, you might have heard before. Zulu is one of the huge, largest people groups in that area. And Zulu were a group of people that I worked with. I worked as a student chaplain, working with probably 75% Zulu, and then a sort of European descent South Africans and a lot of international students as well. And we wanted to get people, as we did ministry, to understand who Jesus really was, the biblical Jesus. Our group was called the Bible Talks. We wanted to see Jesus as he was in Scripture, not in culture or sort of some denominational church's philosophy. And we ran into a few snags, because one of the words that was a stumbling block was the Zulu word for God. Our Zulu word for God is umkulumkulu. I won't get you to say that. Umkulumkulu, which was a word that missionaries, when they were translating the Bible, had to take from the Zulu, so whatever their sort of tribal cultures, to say, what is the ultimate God? The God in charge of everything, because they believed in a few other things. But umkulumkulu, as you see that sort of repeat, means, I'm told, the one that's up, ha-ha. It's the sky god, the one above everything. And so for them, God, and the word meant someone that was really quite distant, all-powerful, but higher up. And so we had to work with him to see that that he isn't just high up there. He's made himself known through Jesus, and you can have a relationship with him. The other thing was, culturally, in Zulu culture, and this was hard working as a young man, that you are considered a youth until you're married. Maybe when you get to 50, I think you automatically by default become an adult. But they would have seen you as just a young person. And they also saw God as Jesus as God's little boy. So he's just his errand boy type thing. He's at his beck and call. And often also with some of the other influences of some movements, of charismatic movements, particularly rife in Africa, quite different. They saw him as more a genie. So you could just, when you needed something, You dial up Jesus, get him to help you pass that exam, and then you just carry on with your life. So they had a view of God that was either too high, he's not interested, how do I relate to him, or a view of God that's too low, he's there to do what I need to do. And as you see those two cultural things, I think if you look at our culture, you'll see that there's not, we might not use the word mkulunkulu, but there are similarities. People can have a view of Jesus that's too low. Jesus is my BFF. If you don't know what that means, don't worry. Or he just seems a bit unimpressive. He is someone I just call up when I need help. And he's a good man in history, but really far removed from me. Nothing to do with my day-to-day life. Or maybe he's just not real, or it's just something to make you feel special. And that's a view of Jesus that is too low. And if we have a view of Jesus that's too low, then we're not going to listen to him because we're going to relate to him on some of those viewpoints. Or you might have a view of Jesus that's too high, so the Jesus of the stained glass window, or Renaissance paintings, or some concept that is just too far up there, that's far up and distant and unreal, that I can't relate to. Now, those might be our cultural views, but I find myself slipping into some of these viewpoints. Often I might take Jesus for granted or just listen to some of what he has to say unless it makes me uncomfortable. Or sometimes when I'm going through a hard time, I feel like he doesn't really care for me. I'm just a number in the system, an employee. He knows my national insurance number, but he doesn't really know anything about me, and he can feel distant. And I'm sure I'm not the only one that, as we struggle to see Jesus as he really is, this will impact how we listen to him. So if we can get the picture of who Jesus is as the Bible tells us, then when he tells us to do something, that's going to help us listen to him and be shaped by his word. The reason why I'm saying this is that the disciples look like they're going through a bit of a crisis. We're in Mark's gospel halfway through. What's just come before this is that one of the disciples, after spending time with Jesus, finally realized that Jesus isn't just a prophet. He's seen him having power over nature, death, disease, evil, and he goes, "You're this Messiah that we've been waiting for. The whole of the Old Testament has been pointing towards. This is wonderful." And Jesus says, "Yes, that's right, but now I'm going to die." This unsettles them. They're following Jesus. They've been spending time with him. If he's going to die, this is just the end of it all, really. He's meant to restore and make the world a better place. And he says, "Oh, by the way, you're following me. You need to be prepared to suffer as well." And so maybe at this point they're thinking, "I've backed the wrong horse. Fishing business back home starting to look pretty good right now. Jesus is powerful, but some of the stuff he says is just crazy." And so Jesus takes just three of them, probably the core three, Peter, James, and John, and he takes them up for a mountain climb high up. Now, we're told in verse 2 this takes six days after this discussion that they've had about him being the king and then suffering. And so these are linked together. And he has said to them, just if you look at chapter 9, verse 1, he says that some of you here, before you die, will get a glimpse of what I'm all about and my kingdom. And then he takes them up to climb up a mountain. Two things I want us to come away from this passage. I think this passage is saying that if you want to know Jesus, you need to know what his glory is like. And if you want to know Jesus, you need to know what his suffering's like. In fact, if you want to really see him as he is, in all his glory, you need to see his suffering and his glory, how they go together. So the first point we want to see, if we want to know what Jesus is really like, you need to know his glory. And that's verses 2 to 8. We want to see his glory so we can get to know what he's like. So in verses 2 to 8, we see Peter, James, and John, they climb up with Jesus, they go up with Jesus up a high mountain. I used to think of this just as a little hill for the half an hour stroll up. It doesn't say which mountain it is. Some people have speculated, but this is probably the kind of place that in certain times of the year has snow on the top. And so they climb up this mountain and taking off their rucksacks, probably taking in the view, congratulating themselves that they've climbed up, breathing the air, maybe pulling out a sandwich or their water bottle. And next minute, something amazing happens. And you can imagine the sandwich just hovers just before the mouth, or the water bottle is now just pouring out. Because Jesus, we're told in verse 3, his clothes become dazzling white. And this is just, I think, a brilliant, I think this is quite funny, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. So I'm reminded of, I don't know if you had them here, if they're still on TV, but I remember growing up, these detergent ads where two housewives are discussing how great their washing is, and you see the brightness of their white laundry. This is just far surpasses anything like that. This is brighter than any bleach in the world could bleach him. He's dazzling white. And if that's not enough, there with him appears Elijah and Moses, and they're talking to Jesus. Now, I don't know how they know it's Elijah and Moses. Maybe they've got one of those little name badges that we have sometimes in church with a marker written on, or maybe they introduce themselves. I don't know, but they know. And Elijah and Moses are big deals in the Jewish faith. Moses, the who got God's law, and the Exodus. Elijah, who was right at the end of the Old Testament, so Moses in the beginning, trying to bring people back to God. Both of them had encounters with God on mountains. We had one of them with Moses read. Elijah trying to bring people back to God. And now they're there, and it's quite clear who's in control, who's in charge. It's Jesus. And I can imagine if you're the disciples, you've seen him do some pretty impressive things, but this is phenomenal. You know it's not the mountaineer. You see them. And so Peter, who's always good at sort of speaking first, says, if you look at verse 5, he's rambling a bit. He starts saying, well, let us put up some shelters, one for you, one for... he wants to put up... let's make this into a camping trip. Whether he's talking about... there's something to do with tents in the Old Testament and God's presence, a tabernacle. We're told he's just rambling. Whether he's just thinking, well, this is good. This is going to be a little bit more of a permanent arrangement rather than just a temporary one. We don't know. We're told he's babbling, and verse 6, we're told they're frightened, as you and I would be. The thing is, why does Jesus take them up to the top of the mountain, only three of the disciples, and then show them this? I mean, don't you think it makes strategic sense? Why don't you go into the center, the heart of Jerusalem, stand in the temple and let this happen? People could really see who you are. In fact, a little bit later after this, Jesus even tells the disciples to keep quiet about it until he rises from the dead. But it's for their benefit, for these three's benefit, that they hear what comes next. Verse 7. Then a cloud appeared and covered them, and a voice from the cloud, came from the cloud. This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him. I think this is the real push of the passage. They're saying, listen to him. See, the disciples aren't seeing Jesus as he is, therefore they're not going to listen to him properly. You need to see who he is before you can listen to him. Well, verse 8, suddenly they look around and everything's gone. There's just Jesus again. And they must be wondering, what's this all about? See, they had this view of Jesus being pretty impressive with his miracles. They've seen Jesus then talking about suffering. Jesus gives them a sort of a trailer or a foreshadow of what his glory is really like. But they still don't really know what's going on. But one thing is clear, they're told that they need to listen to him. That voice from heaven, it's a bit familiar with what our reading, with what Moses experienced, but also in the beginning of Jesus' ministry when he was baptized, the same thing happened. It's God's putting a stamp of approval and saying, this is my son, he's my representative, listen to him. The disciples are probably struggling with this idea of suffering and death. And he's saying, no, this is right. The disciples are probably thinking we've backed the wrong horse. This is the wrong situation. And God is saying, no, this is right, listen to him. And they give him a glimpse. He gives them a glimpse of Jesus in all his glory. Just a glimpse. Now, it's a bit like, it's a morning, probably a bit warmer than this, and you wake up and you've had your curtains open, maybe it was a bit warm, and you're thinking, what's the day going to be like? Is it overcast? Is it worth me getting up? And then the wind just catches the curtain, and this brilliant sunshine just comes shining through into your room just for a moment, and then it's gone. See, that's what's happened here. Just a glimmering of what Jesus is like in all his glory. However, we'll see that that's only half the picture, and that doesn't solve all the problems, because the disciples are still discussing after this what suffering means. He gives them a glimpse, and then as they're coming down the mountain, verses 9 to 13, they start having a bit of a discussion. And 9 to 13 tell us that if we want to know what Jesus is really like, we need to see his suffering. Or maybe to put it a better way, if we want to understand what his glory is truly like, we need to see it with his suffering. And so they're coming down, and verse 9 he tells them not to tell anyone, and I'll read it. Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. Now, if you're taking notes, 2 Peter chapter 1, Peter recounts this, looks back and says, it is after Jesus' resurrection, so he's kept his word. He said, we saw his glory. It suddenly makes sense to him afterwards, but at the time, he doesn't know what it's all about. And so they grasp onto this, and you mustn't tell anyone until the Son of Man, which is a term Jesus used for himself, had risen from the dead. Now, Jesus has said this before in chapter 8, but they've just been focusing on his death. And now they're saying, what does this risen from the dead mean? Now, it's easy for us. How many Easters do you think we've had since this incident? I can't do the math, but it's a lot. And we've had a lot of Easters reflecting on Jesus' resurrection, looking back. The disciples haven't even had an Easter yet. And so when they're rising from the dead, they're probably thinking, as everyone will one day rise from the dead when God comes back. They weren't thinking that he was literally talking about just after his death. And so they don't really understand this. And so they're discussing, well, what's rising from the dead mean? And then verse 10, I think, well, maybe we've got Jesus here. He's talking about suffering. We've seen a bit of his glory. Maybe he doesn't have to suffer, because if Jesus knows his Old Testament well, like the teachers of the law have been teaching, they said that Elijah has to come first. And not just come first like he did on the mountain. He has to come and do a ministry. And that comes from the book of the Old Testament called Malachi, which said that Elijah would come first and come again and fix things up and get things ready for God to do his work. And so they think, aha, we've got him. So that's verse 11. They say, why do the teachers of the law say Elijah must come first? And Jesus responds, Elijah has come. The thing is, they're thinking of a literal Elijah coming again. But what he's talking about is someone would come, like Elijah the prophet. He would try and bring people back to God, like Elijah did. A man that lived out in the wilderness, like Elijah, that wore camel's hair, that ate locust, a man of the land. And really, that was John the Baptist. He was the Elijah-like figure getting things ready for Jesus to come. And so, first of all, this means to the disciples that nothing else big needs to happen. This is it. It's going to happen soon. Jesus is about to change the world and bring about peace with God. But he also says in verse 13, but I tell you, Elijah has come, and they've done to him everything they wished, just as is written about him. Elijah had a time where people hunted him down and wanted to kill him as a prophet. John the Baptist was killed, and now Jesus is saying he's going to be killed too. They see that he can't sidestep the suffering. See, Elijah was going to fix everything, they thought, but Elijah was preparing the way for Jesus to fix everything. And so Jesus says, you can't get away from the fact that I'm going to suffer. I'm going to die, go to the cross. But there will be a resurrection. And so here we have this picture of Jesus suffering, but glory. They go together. Now, a picture to help us hold on to. When Jesus rose from the dead, when he was pretty impressive in appearance. I don't know if he was glowing all the time, but people didn't recognize him straight away. But there was something that marked that had changed. And when Jesus comes back in glory, we'll see that he'll probably be shining like this, but there'll be something that has changed. You see, when Jesus rose again from the dead, what were on his hands and his feet and his side? There were scars of suffering. And so Jesus will come back in all his glory, but he'll still have the scars of suffering, a picture of glory and suffering. The suffering show that God is a God that gets his hands dirty, that's noble, that knows what it's like for you and I to suffer daily. He's a God that gives himself to the last degree, to his last breath, so that we can be friends with him, made right relationship with him, and need not suffer judgment. That's what it means to be a God of suffering. But he's not just a servant. He is God fully in all his glory that comes to do that. And when those two go together, you start to see Jesus as he is. And when God says, listen to him, it's probably a lot easier. Or even if it's not that easier, it helps to motivate us. See, for the disciples, it meant, listen to me even if it means suffering, even when things are difficult. And for us today, what does it mean to listen to Jesus, the King of glory and of suffering? Well, it means that we might need to count the cost when it comes to comfort. My heart is a bit like, when it comes to listening to God's words, a bit like the sweet pick and mix store. Like we've got just down the road here, where you can go in and you can go, oh yeah, I'll have that sweet. I like the licorice, but not the humbugs. Leave those alone. And we could be like that with God's word, taking parts that we like. So we're listening to him, but only the parts that we like. Because we're forgetting of who he is, suffering and glory, servant and king. And so for us, what does it mean to listen to him? It means to listen to him in everything. When it comes to things that we do in private, when it comes to maybe it goes against our comfort, our security. I mean, because it's devastating when someone doesn't do that. So in my study, I've got a book, and it's written by a guy that has helped me so much as he just spoke about what the gospel is. A great, wonderful guy. But a few years ago, it came out that he'd been having an affair, cheating on his wife, and he hasn't been that repentant on the matter. And that really, it really is difficult. How could you have someone write such brilliant things? And I think it's because he's probably listening to God in some areas and not in others. And I can't judge him because we do the same. So we need to be people that have integrity. So when it comes to listening to the laws of the land, whether it's in private or public, when it comes to behaving sexually in our thought life and actions, when it comes down to being honest with people, always letting our yes be yes and not telling that white lie, maybe even to our children. And so we hold these two pictures of Jesus and we say, you're the King of glory and you're the King that suffered for me. Help me to listen to you in public and in private and for your glory. There's no excuse not to listen to Jesus. See him as he is and listen to him. And we need prayer to do this as we do this together. Amen.